I'd like to read part of a poem by the 13th century mystic Hafiz, the Sufi master, born in Persia, and actually who had a tremendous influence on Goethe and Ralph Waldo and Emerson, as well as Garcia Lorca, Nietzsche, and Sherlock Holmes quotes him. So there you go. This is called So Many Gifts. There are so many gifts still unopened from your birthday. There are so many handcrafted presents that have been sent to you by God. The beloved, which is what he calls source, love, lover, and the beloved, does not mind repeating, everything I have is also yours. When ages ago, every cell in your soul capsized forever into this infinite golden sea. There are so many gifts, my dear, still unopened from your birthday. So that leads me right into what I want to talk about this morning. Modern society has brought an increasing sense of isolation, anxiety, depression, addictions, loneliness, and spiritual alienation for many. If not you, certainly for people you and I know. I've witnessed it in friends, colleagues, family. I certainly felt it frequently, sometimes at twilight, sometimes in the darkness before dawn. And I propose that these states are not natural, that they arise because our implicit child trust was betrayed, was broken, resulting in our unconsciously very early in life disconnecting from our tender body and our senses, and subsequently from our Mother Earth and from community. The result for many of us is that we live mostly in our heads. To experience betrayal and loss is a natural and inevitable part of living. However, it is not meant to occur at the very start of life. When we are in our mother's womb, during birth, or soon afterwards, at the times when our brain and body are rapidly developing and we are bonded with and dependent upon our mother, this is known as the primal period. Now, you wouldn't stress a new plant, would you? You know that stress is important for plants to make them strong, but not when they're setting their roots down. They need just the right conditions. And if we stress a tree or a vegetable or a flower too soon, it will never grow fully. And so it is with people. Loneliness and alienation are not common features of tribal life or life in some closely bonded extended families. So I was not surprised, but very sad, when I read of research done in 2005, a random survey funded by the National Science Foundation of 1,500 men and women, in-depth, face-to-face interviews, concluding that one out of every four adults in this country claim they have no one with whom they can talk about or discuss personal troubles. That was twice the number that said that in 1985. Does this surprise you? Other well-done research has found 40% of Americans saying they are lonely. And we know that the internet has double-edged sword, it's been, and likewise cell phones and Facebook in terms of making people feel connected and more lonely. Social isolation may arise from current life conditions. However, a deep sense of loneliness is not the same as the feeling of separateness we feel when we are ill, or say, being a new mother, a home alone with her baby, when everyone in the neighborhood is out at work. It's not the same as the chosen period of solitude, even though it may be hard to endure that. I'm talking about the loneliness deep underneath that never goes away. Social isolation, loneliness, is actually a disease, and it puts a person at high risk for most diseases and for premature death, equal to smoking and actually twice that of the risks of obesity. Sometimes loneliness does drive us to deep spiritual seeking and results in personal transformation. even in youthful years. It also drives many to embrace religious fundamentalism and political extremism, and finding comfort in black and white answers delivered by others to the complexity and paradoxical nature of many challenges, maybe most, in life. In these groups, many find true belonging. And the same is true in teenage gangs. And I would say in ISIS and in people who perpetrate tremendous harm on strangers everywhere. Loneliness can also show up as a walling off of the heart, not trusting, and spiritual alienation, and the sense of awe in the face of the big mystery is gone, and it's a kind of living death. I'm looking for the root causes, for when something can be accurately named, I've discovered we have a greater chance of being able to address it, accept it, make friends with it, even heal it. So what is it we all long for? First, to be seen. Second, to feel we have value. And third, to belong. I don't know how many of you saw and were deeply moved by the movie Avatar and the tribal scenes in it. Most tribal people feel this right from the womb. It's the air they breathe. And we do have some models to look toward. Their world is alive with presence. Every tree, every creature, every stone, they feel related to it all, and they have each been welcomed into the world by the entire tribe. Now, babies born to tribal people in healthy tribes are bonded to the whole tribe. So I'd like to tell you a little anecdote from Burkina Faso's Dagara people and a friend I have named Sobonfu Somé, who grew up there. Before pregnancy, before physical pregnancy, when a woman or a teenage girl starts to feel the presence of a baby, a spirit around her, or has a dream of a baby, she tells someone, because people tell stories all the time, and the women all gather at the edge of the village with her one night, and they dig a hole in the soft earth in Africa, and they place her naked in that hole, knee to chest, curled like an egg, and they place their hands on her, and they chant and sing to her with their hands on her all night long until the dawn. And she usually has a dream of that baby. And they call this the spiritual cleansing for pregnancy and welcoming the spiritual pregnancy. So how primitive are these people? We never do this. When the baby arrives, and it's usually in the dark of a hut, a windowless hut, all around in circle, the children are all gathered beforehand by a couple of the elders in the village, and they are listening intently for the first sounds this baby makes. And when that baby makes its first cry or sounds, all the children together in unison repeat back to the baby the sounds that they hear. It's a way of welcoming them, and they believe it's a way of saying, you made it, you came to the right place. Because in almost every tribal culture, it is understood that every human being in that tribe comes from far away, bearing a gift that is absolutely essential to the thriving of that tribe. Now, I don't want to romanticize tribal life. It's full of ticks and snakes and dirt and not enough water. They have to squeeze water out of mud in Burkina Faso, where she grew up. But I do want to say that they had some things really right. And it's about time that we pull those things back into modern life, because we've lost them. Now, in fact, we each do have intrinsic worth, and not for anything we've accomplished. Simply for the fact that we exist. We are here, so we belong, and we matter, however we may feel about it. That's the way it's supposed to be. But for people whose trust was implicitly broken, implicit trust was broken at the start of life, betrayed, that is not a felt sense in our bodies, in their bodies. And I'm thinking of young people who commit suicide. I'm thinking of so many people now. I'd like to take a look at the first 18 months of our life, the 9 months developing in the womb, which nobody talks about, the wet, warm womb of the world, and the effort of labor and birthing ourselves or being cut open from the mother and born into the world by cesarean, and then emerging into the larger world, and then the first hours and days afterwards, we completely reorganize our body from being a water being tethered to the mothership to an air-breathing being who has to regulate its own temperature, find food. And eventually toddle off into the direction of whatever turns us on. So all the qualities that we here in this room today value, caring, community, respect, social justice, honoring all life in all its diversity, finding ways to behave with respect and nonviolently and live cooperatively, these are meant to arise naturally. And if and when our needs are met at the primal stage of life as we're putting our roots down, this is when we're developing our sense of the world. And babies in the womb are actually making decisions about what the world is. By the way, scientists are showing that infants naturally show compassion and a preference for beauty. So the newest child of cell biology, epigenetics, which means above or around the genetic coding, because it's not nature and nurture, it's nature and nurture, have proven that our DNA is just the blueprint of our potentialities. It's really the environment that triggers the specific genes to turn on or off, the environment that triggers the genes for music, musicality. And with unhealthy traits too, and virtually all mental illnesses fall into this category. Unnaturally high levels of stress at conception, in the womb, through the umbilical cord of the mother where we're receiving the hormones of all her emotions, during birth, in the first hours and weeks afterwards, and even in the intensive care nursery, which is a brutal place, these can turn an unwanted gene like schizophrenia or bipolar on. Now, the same trait can lie dormant in the next generation if those children's needs are met. And if that mother has a fairly easeful pregnancy, positive feelings about herself and the coming baby, feels welcomed into the community, valued, or simply feels good about her life regardless of circumstances. And this has been proven whether she is living on a garbage dump in Brazil. It's her attitude as much as her emotions. Interesting. So our cells grow in a binary way. This is the only way we're like computers. On or off. Right from the preparation of our mother's egg that will one day be fertilized by a father's sperm and become a zygote and then a human being, all these billions of cells that are working together, singing together in harmony, are reading the information from the environment and responding by either growing fully or growing in a state of defense. Who's the environment? The mother. Who's her world? We are. Here's the thing, anything trying to grow in a state of defense will never grow fully. Now, this should give us an understanding of the kinds of people who turn to doing horrible things in the world, whether it's people in our own government or people doing it for belief in particular kinds of gods or whatever. There's too much trauma in the world. Human beings have simply had too much unnamed and unhealed trauma. Historical trauma like war and famine, racial trauma like genocide, intergenerational trauma like shame-based parenting and abuse or neglect, and birth-related or primal trauma. And men, interestingly enough, are innately more vulnerable to trauma and get over it with greater difficulty than do women because they are innately less resilient. So what do we do with our boys around the world? We believe in toughening them up. We believe in systematic deprivation to toughen them up and strengthen them. And what do we create? We create brittle, angry, and defensive men. So the neurosciences have proven what a difficult job it is to parent and how it can't be done in isolation, and that parents are really the artists and the architects and the computer programmers of the body and brain of babies. And it's become a much lonelier and more difficult job today in the shrinking nuclear family of two, or maybe just one, working so many hours trying to support children, stressed, trying to give what our children need. Think of immigrants. Think of people who don't speak English well. Think of so many underserved people in this country, but also think about people who are wealthy and are having some of the same challenges in a different way. Feeling not valued, lonely, and not having any real community. Each mother and baby, it is now proven, are one biological system, and when we do something to one that is good or bad, we do it to the other. And our babies are growing in a state of defense, a larger hindbrain, and our mothers are stressed. Take a look at what's happening in Israel, in Palestine, all over the world. These children are growing up in trauma. It takes 9 months for a human being to develop to the point where a baby horse is within minutes of being born. Physiological maturity that allows it to stand on its legs, flee from danger, and follow its food source. Takes us 9 months. We're not separate when we cut the umbilical cord. In fact, it takes the outer womb. Ashley Montague told us about this in the book Touching. The outer womb, held in arms, slept with, warm. We humans are paradoxically both exquisitely sensitive and aware, even in the womb, and innately trusting and resilient, and also very vulnerable to trauma. And so are women in childbearing and as new mothers. And infants do not get what they need from being in full-time daycare at 6 weeks of age or even 6 months of age, nor in front of a TV with an overstressed person who's grunting and hardly speaking to a baby, as happens in many families that are stressed. And on top of it all, we have nature deprivation. Tragic because nature is what connects us to ourselves, our senses, and our soul, naturally. By the way, our earliest memories are implicit memories. They exist in ourselves, whether we are conscious of them or not. And they're still running our lives in many cases. And our mother's breasts, where do you think the term the milk of human kindness came from? Taking in that sweet, warm nourishment, gazing up into her eyes, the scent of her skin, the feel of her heartbeat. I wasn't breastfed. The pediatrician said to my mother, "Eleanor, you're a school teacher, not a cow." That was 1938 for my brother's birth, and she never breastfed any of us. Science is unwrapping more and more of the mystery of what it means to be fully human and how to rear children capable of reaching their full potential and creating a good world, really being stewards of this earth and living in harmony, in a dynamic harmony with all of life. Conscious conception, low-stress pregnancy, natural childbirth, breastfeeding, sleeping alongside and wearing our babies, picking them up even before they cry, and ending shame-based parenting, schooling, and patriarchal forms of religion. These are the antidote, I feel, to modern loneliness and spiritual alienation, addiction, aggression, suicide, and so much more for the next generation. It just takes one generation. We could do this. It's affordable. It's sustainable. And by the way, my husband, Bob Hartman, writes a blog called endingpatriarchy.org. And it's about the sacred feminine and reconnecting and about shifting the way we raise our boys. I'd like to think of this congregation and the principles that guide UU as creating a safe place, a trust-based community, a cradle or chalice that honors each person and holds each of us gently as we journey to remember fully who we are and why we came. Especially those who were not properly welcomed and nurtured at the start of life. It is never too late to heal the wounds of the soul. And that's the good news.